Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to this week's Classic Replay. It's Justin here to introduce today's show from the archive. Is belief in the supernatural inherent from birth? Is Christianity a psychological crutch or a path to emotional wholeness? Is God belief simply a result of evolution? Would it make belief in untrue if it were? Well, these and more questions get discussed in today's show on the psychology of religion, featuring atheist psychological therapist Martin Frame and Christian tutor of psychology of religion, Reverend Dr. Joanna Collicutt-McGrath, in a show that was first broadcast in July 2010. So thanks for tuning in. And don't forget, you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
We're asking the question on the programme today, is religion a trick of the mind? And in for a friendly chat, really, on the discussion panel today, my two guests are Martin Frame. He's a psychological therapist, an atheist from Glasgow. We'll hear some of his background shortly. Also, Joanna Collicutt, who's a senior lecturer in psychology at Heathrop College in London. And she's a Christian, she's ordained, and we'll be finding out where she stands on the whole issue of the psychology of religion, particularly as it pertains, of course, to Christianity. And so we're going to be looking at things like, well, are our beliefs purely a product of an evolutionary background, if you like? Does that show that there is no real thing as a belief in God? What about the concepts children have of God? What about other aspects? All kinds of things we'll be looking into this afternoon. And as I've said, not so much of a confrontational show this week. I think it's going to be more of a good-natured discussion between the three of us.
We'll see.
says Martin. Let's introduce you both first, though. First of all, perhaps, Joanna, you've never been on the programme before. Martin has at least featured once on the programme, but it would be lovely to get a bit of your background. Joanna, tell us, did you grow up in a Christian family? Were you sort of...
I grew up in a family where my mother was a Christian and my father was an agnostic stroke atheist. And I went through a period of adolescent atheism, which is a well-known psychological syndrome, between the ages of about 10 and 13. And then when I was 13, over a period of several weeks, a month, I came back into an adult Christian faith. And one of the incidents that prompted that was wrestling with the question of are we the products of evolution, and is there really anything more to us than that? And I had a particular experience that led me to see things in a different way than I had previously been seeing them, and to understand that God is greater than the minds of any of us, including the most brilliant scientists.
Would you mind sharing what that incident was in a nutshell, or is it rather too big to do?
I'll try and be brief. When I was about six or seven, I was being coached for an exam to get into a school, and I'd learnt all my times tables up till 12 times 12, and I was really slick at these. And I was being tested on them by my father, and he was getting frustrated that I wasn't making any mistakes. And so he asked me what 13 times 13 was, and I said, it doesn't exist. And as soon as I'd said it, I thought, oh, that can't be right. And he laughed and said, you're wrong. And I knew I was wrong. Couldn't work out what it was. Still not sure. And It was about, must have been about 5 years later, I was sitting in a church and listening to a rather dull sermon, but in that sermon the preacher said, the sort of person who thinks that science is incompatible with the existence of God is rather like a child who thinks 13 times 13 doesn't exist because they haven't got there yet in their times tables. And that made me think, ooh. And it began me on a kind of new way of questioning about these
things. What an interesting story. Thank you very much for sharing that. You have also, I mean, I first came into contact with your name as the co-author of the Dawkins Delusion, which you wrote along with your husband, Alistair McGrath. I mean, your area, though, is psychology of religion. Do you feel like there's much crossover in terms of this, you know, the kind of new atheism that Dawkins et al. Represent and what you're doing? Do you feel like...
Quite a lot of the... I mean, I've read a lot of what Dawkins wrote earlier in his life, but in The God Delusion, which is the book we were responding to in our book, he uses a lot of material from the general field of psychology of religion in his argument. So there is quite a lot of overlap. He uses kind of neuroscientific evidence, and he uses evidence from a subfield in psychology of religion called cognitive science of religion to support some of his arguments. The other area I'm interested in is biblical studies, and Dawkins talks quite a lot about Jesus and makes assertions about the Bible in that book. And so it was actually those that irritated me sufficiently to contribute to it.
Thank you for coming in today. And our other guest today, Martin Frame, who came on by telephone, I think, on a previous occasion, doing in a discussion with a number of other participants, actually, with David Robertson a few months ago now. But Martin, you've been listening to the show, I think, for over a year, and we've been in touch here and there occasionally, and we found a date when you could come down. But you're a psychological therapist, which you tell me is different to a psychologist. The two aren't the same.
Yeah. All that means is after my honours degree in psychology, I did a master's degree in psychological therapy. So I'm a psychologist.
And it's more on the practical side, engage in this.
Yeah, it's CBT that I use, cognitive behavioural therapy, which is kind of very much focused on what's keeping a person's problems going and looking at changing those maintaining factors to help the person help themselves ultimately. So
you'd now describe yourself as an atheist, though. I think you don't quite like just the term atheist.
Well, only because an atheist doesn't really tell you much. It only tells you what you're not, as opposed to what you are. You're not someone who believes in God, but you could be a communist, a hedonist, or a humanist as an atheist. I tell you an atheist, I'm not telling you much else.
Are you a communist, then, or a hedonist?
No, I would say I'm a humanist, so...
Yeah. But you haven't always, you would have seen yourself as an atheist. Tell us a little of your background.
Well, kind of briefly, I grew up in a nominally Protestant household that wasn't particularly interested in religion. When I kind of became a young teenager, I began to realise that there are more religions in the world than just Christianity, and it made me think, well, surely no one religion can claim, exclusivity to the truth. So I was of the opinion that all religions must be saying something true about the kind of big questions about why we're here and the nature of God and so on. In my later teenage years, I became really interested in kind of New Age spirituality, which again teaches that all religions ultimately have the same source and convey the same sort of message. And then, when I was about 20 years old, I came across the Baha'i Faith. And the Baha'i Faith teaches that all religions come from God, have the same purpose for humanity. Each divine revelation is conferred to humanity in accordance with the requirements of the age. And I thought, well, this is what I already believe. So it didn't take me long to embrace the Baha'i Faith. I suppose shortly after, I kind of recognised some problems with the Baha'i Faith that for many years I was able to somehow rationalise or pretend did not exist. So, for instance, the Baha'i Faith teaches in the harmony of science and religion, yet accepts miracles, and I think these two positions are incompatible. Later on, I returned to university to do a second degree in psychology, which I think set the foundations for my future non-belief. When you study psychology, you kind of learn the extent to which we have the capacity to deceive ourselves. And I began to question, you know, what my beliefs were and why I held them and so on. And then, well, then the God Delusion came out. And I intended to read it, but before I read the God Delusion, I read the Dawkins Delusion, I guess, to try to inoculate myself against what Richard Dawkins' arguments might be. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, after reading the God Delusion, I didn't become an atheist. So I read the Dawkins Delusion, and I thought it was fine. I suppose maybe it had less impact on me because I wasn't a Christian, perhaps. But before I got round to reading The God Delusion, I read Sam Harris' The End of Faith, which was the end of my faith after
reading
closing that book. That was it. I couldn't rationalise the difficulties that I had with the Baha'i faith any longer. I began to see that this idea that, which Sam Harris talks about in his book, in which the Baha'i faith teaches that, you know, God... you know, there's a supernatural God that answers prayers, performs miracles, occasionally writes holy books and so on. I thought, no, that's just naive. I can't accept this anymore. And that, with the problems that I had with Baha'i faith anyway, I thought, no, can't do this anymore, and ultimately embraced a naturalistic and secular humanist worldview.
Have you run into that book yourself,
no,
Joanna? The
I
End
haven't.
Of Faith? I think it's been more popular, I think, in America than over here. Certainly, I think Sam Harris is someone, a neuroscientist, deals in neuroscience, and so hence there is an overlap with the whole area of psychology of religion, etc.
Yeah, I think he's done a PhD in neuroscience, but his undergraduate was in philosophy. So, I mean, his arguments are more philosophical than encroaching on psychology and so on.
Just wanted to add that, as a piece of information, before, in a previous life, before I was a psychologist of religion, I was a clinical psychologist and I was a cognitive therapist.
So
we have quite a lot in common there too. Yeah,
I'm sure you'll also, you know, share, you know, you won't disagree profoundly on many things today, I think
we'll
it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see what you do disagree on and where there are areas of agreement. During the course of today, you know, I'd like us to sort of talk about the whole aspect of whether, you know, we are in some sense biased to be religious by our background, and whether that suggests therefore that belief in God is in some sense not true or is invalidated by that. I think very often when people do say, well, you can trace back belief in God to these kinds of things in our evolutionary past, that they believe that therefore disproves that these beliefs are true. I suppose, though, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. It doesn't necessarily follow that the beliefs are therefore untrue, because you can show a pathway for how someone arrived at those beliefs. But either way, I'm sure we'll have a good discussion on all kinds of areas.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
It's the show with a question mark on the end, because this is the show where we have open and honest discussions, questions put out there, and hopefully it's a place where we generate a bit more light than heat. In usually, at least, sometimes it feels like more heat than light with some shows, but it'll be fascinating to hear what you guys, you know, have to say in this area. What was your? I put this as a show title to you, Joanna, and I don't know what you make of it, because every word, you know, you could make a show out of. But is religion a trick of the mind? What was your first thought when I suggested that title to you? Do you find people coming to you with that kind of a view, that religion really is just a sort of, you know, a misfiring in the brain, or a kind of...
I think people are really interested in the notion of truth and reliability, and are the beliefs that you base your life on, do they have a solid grounding? And one of the questions we ask ourselves is, am I, to use your phrase, deceiving ourselves in some way, and how can we... No. And so, yes, that is the kind of question people come with. I might not have used the term religion, actually, as of choice, because I think a lot of what we may talk about today may refer to religion and religious beliefs. And I think there's an argument for saying that the Christian gospel in particular, but actually a whole load of notions of the divine and the transcendent, may not map easily onto the phenomenon of religion, which is something perhaps a little separate. So religion would be the bit that I would perhaps query most. Mm. But Trick is quite nice, and we are talking about the mind. We're both psychologists, so...
Yeah, I mean, obviously you talked, you know, in this whole area, you come across writings that would suggest that people have a propensity to believe certain things. I mean, do you think that our, if you like, there is some kind of innate, if you like, predisposition to believe in the supernatural, to give a supernatural explanation for things?
I think on balance, yes. That's a big term again, the supernatural, but there's evidence to suggest that people seem to have a tendency to make explanations of events that involve agents. It's much easier and more natural for us to say that, you know, our computer's in a bad mood today, or it's playing up, or the photocopier's got something against us. We naturally fall into that way of thinking about the world. And some theorists would say, because we have that natural tendency to use kind of purposeful explanations that attribute agency to all sorts of objects, and indeed a kind of ease in imagining immaterial and invisible agents, that might account for our propensity to continue to believe in God in a scientific age.
Mm. You obviously dropped your belief in God, Martin, presumably because you felt that ultimately when you sat down and looked at all the evidence, you found that there simply, psychologically, there was too much going on there to suggest that this really is just an honest account of the way things are. I mean, particularly, I think you've been sort of the whole aspect of whether where our beliefs come from, you know, in an evolutionary story, has influenced you as to why you... So give us the background to that, and we could have a...
Yeah, I mean, just going back to the question, is religion a trick of the mind? You know, in some ways, I don't like the way the question is asked, because a trick implies a kind of simple, intentional deception by one person of another, and clearly religion is a complex human phenomena that can't be described adequately as a mere trick. But I would argue that it's almost certainly true that people are deceiving themselves if they think that God, religion, or the supernatural are in any sense real. I think in order to understand religion from a psychological perspective, one thing that we need to understand is the evolutionary origins of religious belief. And amongst scholars, there's a debate between the so-called adaptationists, those who believe that religion evolved because it conferred survival advantages to our ancestors, and those who believe that religion is a byproduct, a consequence of other cognitive mechanisms that evolved to solve recurrent problems in human ancestral environments. Joanna touched on one there, the idea of agent detection, which is our kind of natural proclivity to impute agency. Agent detection means assuming the presence of another creature with intentional or volitional behaviour. And that seems quite natural, and has that seems to be an example of why religion is a byproduct. So the idea is that our evolutionary ancestors on the African savannah, if they heard a rustle in a nearby bush, they had to ask, well, you know, is it a predator about to pounce, a malicious enemy, an evil disembodied spirit, or just the wind? If you assume that it's the wind when it's a predator about to pounce, then you're less likely to survive to become our ancestors. But if you assume that it's an agent of some description, even if it's the wind, then that allows you to escape just in case. And so this seems to be a kind of natural aspect to our human psychology.
And for you, that the fact that you could get to a kind of evolutionary explanation of why we're inclined to believe, for you suggests that well, there really actually is nothing out there. What we have as beliefs is really just a fact of our makeup.
What we have, I think, I mean, this is the way I see it, that we have kind of naturalistic evolutionary explanations for the emergence of religious belief. So full stop. That you know, there's no reason to invoke God. It doesn't rule out God absolutely, of course not. But I don't think anything ever can.
But on the balance, if you like, it's a tick against belief in that sense. If you're looking at a kind of, collective kind of evidence for and against whether belief is true, this would score against belief.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to kind of considering religion as a byproduct, so we have got a natural tendency to impute agency to different things, it would seem an odd way for God to create the religious impulse in man merely as a byproduct.
Sure.
That doesn't seem there's intention behind that.
I'll ask Joanne, what do you make of this whole area? I mean, are you fairly convinced by these sort of naturalistic explanations of where religious belief comes from? Do you find the theories sort of compelling or?
No. I think there's lots of interesting and intriguing ideas, and we've mentioned some of them, that are based on general observation and on some quite specific kind of experimental research, which suggests that people have certain proclivities to think in certain ways. And you can then make a story up about that as to how those things may have come into being, given evolutionary pressures on the species, and we've just heard one of those stories, and it's a fairly plausible story, and it's an interesting story, and it's worth pausing and thinking about it. Nevertheless, it is still a story, among other stories about why we are perhaps the way we are. So I'm not utterly convinced, and you know, as Martin has said, there's several theories that are in debate with each other within that kind of evolutionary camp. Lots more research needs to be done. A lot of the findings on, for instance, our propensity to detect agents haven't been replicated systematically across cultures or across experimental groups. So we need to do lots more research, but the ideas are interesting, but I don't think we can be conclusive about them yet. So that's the first thing. I guess the second thing for me, though, is there's a very big jump from having certain propensities in one's thinking. So the propensity to see purpose in events or to see design in objects. I think there's a very big jump from there to full-blown individual faith in God and, indeed, full-blown religious traditions. There's a lot more to be said about these things. So the evolutionary stuff may shed a little tiny bit of light, but I don't think it's a full explanation. And I don't think, even if it were a full explanation, it would necessarily rule out the truth claims of religion.
I suppose that's the thing. I've sometimes heard people say to suggest that by explaining where a belief comes from makes that belief, you can therefore show that belief's not true. That's sort of a genetic fallacy, you know, to show where something comes from does not therefore make that belief claim untrue. Even if, you know, you might have arrived at a true belief even by a completely circuitous route that in no way kind of really, but that doesn't change the fact that thing might still be true nonetheless.
Yeah.
I mean, from your point of view, does, if you know, we granted Martin you know, that these stories of how belief came to arise biologically were true, would that count against belief in God, as I'm sensing Martin is edging towards that on the, you know, on the overall score sheet, it's another kind of tick in the kind of belief is just is not a rational thing.
I think what you're saying, Martin, is actually quite focused on the idea that naturalistic explanations that rule God out of the picture, really, if I've understood that right. And I guess I don't
naturalistic explanations rule God out. They just show that God is not required
unnecessary
to explain
hypothesis.
Religious belief. Exactly, yes.
Yeah. So if you had a full, could give a full naturalistic account of all religious experience, belief, behaviour, culture, which, you know, as a matter of fact, we don't have. But if we did have, our difference would be that I would just be saying, well,
this is the way God did it.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is the way God did it, but this is how we got where we got.
I mean, okay, we're talking about the psychology of religious belief, okay, and the kind of the stories, as you put it, as to why we have this tendency. So let's take the idea of the theory of mind, okay? So theory of mind refers to our ability to attribute minds to other people and infer mental states that differ from one's own, okay? It's called a theory because we can't directly observe the minds of other people but must infer them from their behaviour.
So just to boil that down, I can tell that you're not happy if you're acting in a kind of grumpy way and not smiling.
I'm not that grumpy. Not the smile.
Oh, not at all. I wasn't going to you, Martin, but
yes, exactly.
The sense that we can infer that someone else has the same types of thing going on in their head as we have in ours.
So related to this, Paul Bloom, psychologist, describes human beings as natural-born dualists because we instinctively separate the body, which we can both see and feel, from the mind, which we can neither see nor feel. So it's a short step from attributing minds, which you can't see, to the next step, positing non-material minds that don't have to be attached to bodies, and from there to immaterial souls, and then supernatural God or gods. So it seems to be a kind of natural
progression out of kind of what we start with to kind of
extrapolating. It's a consequence, a byproduct. We believe in supernatural agencies as a byproduct of our theory of mind abilities.
We're going to come back. I'll come back to you for that in a moment, Joanna, but we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to a discussion this afternoon on the psychology of religion. And we're asking, to boil it down to a very simple kind of question, is religion a trick of the mind? And we're expounding on that and asking things like, where do our beliefs come from? Is there just a sort of evolutionary explanation for why we believe certain things? Or is there more to it than that? We'll look at the concept of whether, you know, children's, if you like, innate belief in agency and supernatural explanations may have anything to shed on this. Is Christianity in some sense a psychological crutch because humans need to feel better about themselves? These are the sorts of issues we'll be looking at in the rest of today's programme. So do hope you can join us on the other side of a short break here on the programme that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Unbelievable. Just in the last section there, Joanna, Martin was suggesting that essentially what were you suggesting again, Martin? It's gone out of my head now. But you were essentially
talking about
the theory of mind.
And how that can
these are the kind of intelligent things we discuss on this show. But
yeah.
but yes, we kind of make this jump from a kind of natural assumption that other people have a mind that is somehow independent of their physical body, and we sort of extrapolate then to a kind of ultimate immaterial mind that we call God, and so in some sense these are the things that explain where these beliefs come from. Is that a plausible explanation? Does it make any difference to whether God exists or not for you, Joanna?
To me it doesn't make any difference as to whether God exists, but I do think it informs a lot of the kind of recurrent beliefs that you get within religious traditions, especially within Western Christianity, and how easily those aspects of the Christian tradition are received by people. So I think we are natural dualists. We do, and that's kind of there in our culture post-Descartes in a way as well. So we're kind of evolutionarily natural dualists for the reasons Martin said. And there is something about certainly modern and postmodern culture that also supports that. And so any understanding of the Christian faith that feeds into that dualistic worldview is something that we can easily hold on to and make sense of. And then I think it does become an interesting question for those of us who are people of faith as to how much our faith tradition, and for those of us who are Christians, how much the witness of the Gospels about Jesus and the first people who encountered him how much our reception of those foundational stories are coloured by our tendency to be dualists. One of the interesting things about the biblical witness, I guess, going back years before Christ, is that within the Hebrew faith tradition, there is much less of a tendency to dualism as there is in the later traditions that are influenced by Greek and Roman thinking. The kind of thoughts about what constitutes a human being seem to be much more integrated than our modern understandings. And we read back into those, I think, sometimes a kind of dualistic worldview. And one of the kind of interesting and exciting things to me about the Christian faith is the idea of incarnation, where flesh and what might be thought of as immaterial spirit are held together in the ultimate revelation of God. They're not split. And yet we have great difficulty in getting our heads around that integrated notion. I think precisely because of some of the reasons Martin's been talking about, we think in certain ways. So what I think a lot of this evolutionary cognitive science tells us is why we receive God in ways that do less than justice to him. But I don't think they disprove the existence of God. I don't think a lot of this material can either prove or disprove the existence of God. It's kind of neutral in my
view. I mean, do you think that battleground is a different one in that sense then? I mean, is it just purely a subjective one? I just happen to have the belief, or is it that there are other areas of science or history that you think you bring into play if you're trying to...
Well, I don't think I would ever go about trying to prove the existence of God. I don't think it kind of works in that way. I don't think, actually, Orthodox Christianity makes lots of claims about the supernatural essence of God. And so I think natural explanations are not a particular kind of challenge to Orthodox Christianity. But we do, as Christians, make great claims about the moral nature of God. And so I think... In a sense, you know, I'm opening up a slightly separate area. But, you know, when people ask, why is the world in this state? Why did I pray to God and he didn't seem to answer my prayers? There's questions, they're kind of moral questions around that, about what is the nature of this goodness of God that we proclaim when we look around us and see a world that is clearly not good in all respects. And more work needs to be done in kind of engaging with those kind of questions.
I think you feel that Christianity, Martin, to some extent, is in some sense our way of dealing with the world, or religion in general is. But you know, looking at Christianity and what it says about the world and who we are and that kind of thing, you sense that you particularly, I think, focus in on the idea of original sin and the idea that humanity is somehow fallen and needs restoration or fixing in some way. I mean, I suppose you in a sense fix people on a psychological basis on a regular basis.
Well.
But in a sense that ultimately Christianity is in that sense a psychological tool that people have used to kind of find a way of, you know, reconciling their own personalities and things like that. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, is it therefore for you in some sense, does that demote it in some sense to kind of a status where it you have to see it as simply a way something people have grasped onto and not having it.
I mean, Christianity is not unique. I think all religions, to some extent, appeal to our psychological and emotional needs, and perhaps in different ways. I mean, I understand that, you know, the idea of original sin in Christianity is quite an important doctrine, at least for some branches of Christianity. But, you know, this idea that the kind of essential nature of the human being is one of defilement and corruption and immorality, I find so quite depressing sometimes. You know, I think what a dismal and, you know, disheartening view that some Christians have of other people. But I do actually think the concept of original sin. I think it does say something. I think the concept is quite useful, and I think it says something quite profound about the human condition. I mean, we all, to a certain extent, you know, carry it within us feelings of inadequacy, a kind of a sense of sort of brokenness that we're somehow in need of healing of some kind. We're aware of our own sort of flawed nature. you know, we're kind of aware of the mistakes that we've made in the past. We carry guilt for hurting other people, a sense of shame perhaps when we know that we've done wrong. And perhaps also we've got a kind of sense of this ideal, perfect person that we wish we were, and we recognise how far we fall short from this ideal. And so we call out to God. We call out to God to love us and to forgive us and to accept us despite our fallen nature.
I mean, obviously, Christians very often talk about the need to be Christ-like, and would you see that as a kind of Christ being the perfect human, if you like, the perfect representative of humanity, that is in some sense another psychological aspect of Christianity, that we do have a model that we can aspire to in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can speak for other Christians, as you know, I wouldn't want to try to do that. Do Christians see Christ as a role model to which, you know, he's the sort of exemplar of how to live our lives? Is that true? Well, I don't know, but I mean, the way I can understand original sin is that we have a sense of brokenness within ourselves, that we're somehow inadequate, but we want to be loved and accepted nevertheless, and so we call out to God. We call out to God to love us and to forgive us and to accept us despite
our fallen nature. It's probably fair to say that the vast majority of people who do come to faith in some sense are not necessarily coming to faith because they've been convinced by a historical and philosophical argument. It's because there is, in a sense, that some kind of need that they find is fulfilled at the moment they accept Christ. I'm sure in your pastoral experience, this comes to the fore an awful lot, Joanna, that people, you know, have all kinds of hurts and things within them, which they feel in some sense their faith meets and helps them to kind of make sense of. Is that a fault, though? Is that a kind of psychological, I don't know, crutch in some sense that Christianity provides, which is perhaps where Martin...
Well, I mean, there's lots of things to say about that. I mean, one thing, William James, who was kind of, if you like, the first or one of the very first psychologists of religion, did had a strong view that conversion experiences, mainly to Christianity but to other religions as well, came at the end of a time of turmoil in people's lives where they're searching or difficulties have happened to them. There is a link between traumatic experiences and conversion to different religious traditions, not just Christianity. Coming to faith does seem to often be a kind of resolution, or at least partial resolution, of difficulties that people experienced before. There's a lot of evidence to show that most faith traditions are associated with lower levels of mental ill health and greater well-being, which seems to suggest that indeed they are doing some kind of psychological job for people. Whether or not you believe in the truth claims of any of these faith traditions, they, being part of a religious community and having a strong belief in a transcendent other who is on your side, helps you. So I think that's kind of indisputable, really. And again, it's kind of then a separate question as to whether that you could argue that completely explains the persistence of religious faith over the centuries and the persistence in people's lives in the face of counter-arguments, or whether actually it's just entirely consistent with what the faith tradition is telling us about the nature of God and his interaction with us, which is a relational phenomenon where he is helping us because we come to limits in our lives where we find that we can't help ourselves. So again, I'd say it's neutral, but there's no doubt that religion is not there. Certainly Christianity, and I think most faith traditions, would not be marketing themselves as things that strong people need to make life even better. They're for people who are weak and broken.
I suppose the thing is that, you know, many of the new atheists decry this idea that, you know, we have to have religion to make ourselves feel better. You can live a perfectly fulfilled life as an atheist, as a humanist, and so forth. But for me, I have to confess, there's, and it could well just be my bias, you know, coming, I'm a Christian, and that is bound to influence the way I see things. But I just wonder whether there is a bit of a psychological aversion in many people to the idea of atheism because of what it entails. It does entail that we are just here for a short moment and then gone. There's no kind of ultimate meaning in that sense. You might say, well, you know, in some bigger sense, there's some kind of ultimate meaning. But whereas Christianity says you are actually of significance, you know, there is a God who intentioned you, who created you, etc. I mean, psychologically, that's, in a sense, a more positive psychological thing to believe about the universe than...
I think significance is a really key term there, actually, that I think people do look for personal significance. And certainly Christianity, or the way Christianity is often received by people, is that it does offer you great significance as an individual. I think atheism, there's so many different brands of atheism. Some of them are quite religious-like in that they offer... an explanation, they may offer a community of like-minded people, they may offer a moral code. What they don't offer quite is a personal relationship with a transcendent other. There may be a kind of connection with the universe, but it seemed a little bit cold and impersonal to me, but I'm sure Martin would want to say more about that.
The Christian theologies, you know, there is a purpose for the human race, there's a purpose for each individual, and one's faith is perceived to give one's life more significance. But it's not true that that atheists perceive their life or the lives of anyone else as any less significant. I mean, I happen to think, and speaking from my own experience, that abandoning belief in God and that idea that I'm going to live forever in some, you know, heavenly realm makes this life even more significant, because it helps me realise the importance of the relationships that I have with my friends and family, because this is the time where I have them. This is the time that I value them, and it's up to me now to make... to value my relationships as best as I can, to be fulfilled by them whilst I'm here on earth, which isn't going to be for very long. So
I was going to say, do kind of immediately say atheism, well, that equals a nihilistic philosophy of, you know, there's no meaning.
The idea that life is meaningless to atheists is, well, meaningless.
It's something though that I get the sense, and I could be wrong here, but that people perhaps in some way reach out for something beyond ourselves, because there is this thing inside us that says I want there to be more than just that, and if you come to the belief that actually this is all there is, matter, the universe, and the relationships that exist between myself and other human beings, then you kind of deal with that, and you kind of, you know, come to that in that way. But I don't know, I sometimes meet atheists who I think would like there to be a God, even though they don't believe there is a God.
Because I mean, I might like there to be a God. I mean, I you know, who was it that said that we prefer to believe what we prefer to be true? And I would prefer, to be honest, that there was a God and that I didn't die and that, you know, I live in heaven with my friends and family forever. That sounds nice. like a better deal than the alternative, which is when you're gone, that's it.
But it's about truth, isn't it, or integrity, or something. It's about and that's why, you know, people of faith need constantly to ask ourselves, do we believe what we believe, merely because we want it to be the case, rather than because there's a sense in which we can be sure as anyone can be that we've reached this decision because it's true.
I think Justin, you're right that, you know, we all have a sort of need for answers to the big questions, but, you know, and I suppose when I was a believer, I suppose for me, I had a need to know that my life was of significance, that I was here for a reason, and that, you know, the thought of not existing after death was terrifying to me. But I learned that actually I don't need to know all the answers. You know, there's something about, you know, just marvelling in the uncertainty, which I think going back to you touched on the idea that religion is good for one's mental health, and I absolutely agree. I think religiously active people tend to be psychologically healthier, less depressed than people who are not religious on the whole. That's what the research shows. But there is some research that also shows that it's not being religious per se that correlates with good mental health, but the way in which you hold one's beliefs. So existentially secure atheists are just as psychologically healthy as existentially secure religious believers, both of them more less depressed, psychologically healthier than both atheists and believers that are existentially insecure in their beliefs, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Mm. So it's often the way that we hold our beliefs that influence our mental and psychological well-being.
One thing that I've been really interested in recently is a few articles have come to my attention regarding whether very young children, in fact from birth, we have some kind of innate belief in God. Let me first of ask you, Joanna, what do you think the research shows as the expert in this kind of field? Does overall it look like
there are two lines of research? One is a kind of cognitive line, which is looking at the kind of way that children solve problems and how they use theory of mind and how that develops, something we were talking about earlier, and how that might inform our understanding of children's propensity to see the world as purposeful, as populated by agents, to attribute kind of super knowing properties to immaterial agents. There's that strand of research, and I would argue about that strand of research, which again is kind of patchy in what it's showing. But you can make a story that due to evolutionary pressure, we all come, we're born with a propensity to think in certain ways, and if we are to engage realistically with the world in a scientific frame of mind, that kind of thinking has to be trained out of us. And there was a very influential paper, because it was entitled Are Children Intuitive Theists, I think, which kind of made the jump from the description of these ways in which children think and which we all seem naturally to have a propensity to think, from that to theism, which is a quite a different kind of phenomenon, I would say. There's a big kind of jump there. But the other thing I would say is there's also a strand of research on the development of the spirituality of children. A lot of that's been done by Rebecca Nye, which has looked at qualitative methods, questioning children in depth about their understanding of spiritual matters from relatively young age upwards. And again, there does seem to be a kind of less constrained by a kind of cognitive superstitious thinking, but a more kind of sense of what we might call the spiritual realm of life. Something around playfulness, something around openness to experience, something that Nye calls relational consciousness, an understanding of the joy of being in relationship, not only with other human beings, but with the total universe, that children seem, in the end, to lose rather sadly through the process of education.
Sort of get squeezed out of them in some way.
Yeah. So there are kind of two lines of research on that.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's sort of what it makes me think of in a biblical sense is when Jesus says, you must become like children to enter the kingdom of God. Is there a parallel there for you?
I mean, it's an area I'm really interested in, because I'm interested in how, as we grow up, we reach certain positions in life. We cease to accommodate ourselves to our environment, and we come to our environment with assumptions that have been built up, and we see what we expect to see on the whole. And so actually things have to be pretty in our face for us to shift and change our minds about things. And that's the nature of adult thinking, because it's efficient, and it's we wouldn't get through life if we were constantly changing our minds all the time. And children haven't quite got there yet. They're very open to new evidence. They're very open to playing with new ideas. They see things that perhaps adults miss. And in a way, that openness of thinking that you see in children is something that really high-level scientists also train themselves in, so that they don't miss a really important piece of data because they're coming at it with fixed assumptions about the way the world is. And I think if you look in the Gospels, constantly Jesus is saying to people, you know, it's in front of your faces, but you can't see it. But if you could see things with the eyes of a child and respond to what's in front of you, rather than coming blinkered by pre-existing ideas, you'd be nearer to where God is.
I don't know what you make of that, Martin. I mean, I have had the impression from some brands of atheism that they would like us to believe that children are born with no beliefs whatsoever. They're a blank slate in some sense, and they immediately then either get it's pressed upon them that there is a supernatural explanations and things.
Yeah. To be honest, I think that's wishful thinking on the part of some atheists, that we're all children are born atheists and only, you know, accept beliefs in God and the supernatural due to childhood indoctrination. The psychologist Bruce Hood at Bristol University has written an excellent book called Supersense, and he argues that children are born with a kind of natural, intuitive, which is to say unlearned, way of reasoning about the world that leads to supernatural beliefs and which we don't fully grow out of as adults.
But you would say in some sense it's not wrong that this is in some sense squeezed out, because we do have to accept a kind of a more rational approach to the world. It is a false kind of, presumably, thing. It is a trick, if you like, of our evolutionary past that makes us, as children, be born with these kinds of... propensity.
Yeah,
I
think it's actually.
No, I think, you know, there's been some research on to what extent does one's genes influence religious belief and behaviour. And so, for instance, identical twins who are raised apart share more religious belief and behaviour than non-identical twins that are raised apart. So that seems to suggest that there's something in our genes that builds brains that are predisposed to belief in the supernatural. I suppose it's a different question when it comes to religion, organised religion. I think it's true that we are kind of natural-born supernaturalists. Most of us are, at least. You know, we don't need to indoctrinate our children to have supernatural beliefs, but we probably do to adhere to a particular religion. This is a different question.
Sure,
I mean, you know, the overwhelming majority of religious adults follow the religion of their parents or culture. That you know, so for instance, I put it to maybe both of you that, you know, had you been raised as a Muslim by Muslim parents in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or Bradford or the south side of Glasgow, you would almost certainly be Muslims, in which case you'd be atheists with respect to the beliefs of Christianity. If it's the case that kind of, you know, this is kind of God's way of creating the religious impulse in man, that we sort of defer loyalty to the tribe into which we are born, and it's the case that Christianity is true, then that's it's a kind of rough deal for those who are raised as Muslims.
This comes back to my kind of query about the notion of religion and how closely tied to God and the gospel that is. And I sometimes ask the people in my own parish to reflect on the question of whether Jesus was a religious man or not. And we think about it, and you know, you could perhaps make a case for either. I have a tendency to think that Jesus was very critical of religion, and that possibly was one of the main reasons he ended up crucified. Another thing that is there in the Christian gospel is a very strong message of breaking free from our tendency to in-group affiliation and to open ourselves to the stranger. And that seems to me to be, again, a kind of criticism of some of the things that religion can carry with it. For because although religion is perhaps good for our health, the kind of affiliation and group connection that we get from religion often comes at the cost of religious people being negative about outsiders, non-religious people. And so I would just suggest, because it's something I've been reflecting on recently, that people who are Christian believers listening to this, go away and read Paul's letter to the Romans. And instead of reading it in relation to the law, they just insert the word religion every time they come across the word law in that. Because I think the thrust of what Paul is saying in his letter is, and now we're right with God apart from religion. We're right with God because of a relationship with Jesus Christ. I think it's quite a profound thing, and it's interesting that in chapter 7 of Romans, Paul starts this, oh, wretched man that I am, the good that I would, but I can't, and I wish, which is very much relating to what Martin was saying about the feeling that we kind of all have in us, that despite religion, actually, there are things that we still feel are wrong in our lives. And he also spends chapters and chapters wrestling with the fact that religion brings good, but perhaps it doesn't actually, at the end of the day, lead us to God. And God may reveal himself outside of religion. And I've probably said enough for the time.
Yeah, that we've got. I think plenty of food for thought there as we approach the end of the programme. Martin, ultimately, you obviously came to atheism as for you being satisfactory. Do you feel psychologically satisfied as an atheist? Do you sort of feel that you're psychologically a more fulfilled person now you've, as it were, dropped any belief in the supernatural?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly feel much better for it, to be honest. You know, if it's the case that Christianity is true, I'll come back to this point, then it must be the case that all other religions are false, and that is the same for any other religion as well. So, you know, regardless of the faith that you follow, you should presume that you're wrong, because it's far more likely that any other religion that you don't follow, and there are many more, is far more likely from a statistical point of view that another religion is true.
As an atheist, so I just feel, you believe I just all feel of
more,
them are wrong, though.
I just feel more convinced that I'm not deceiving myself.
I don't think all Christians would say that other religions are wrong. I mean, some might, but I think many would say there are common truths in all religions.
Some Christians might, but I'm not sure if you'll find any Christian theology that says that.
Oh.
That other religions are passed to truth, because if that's the case, then Christianity is nothing special. You know, it could conceivably be that every Christian the world over converts to a different faith tomorrow, okay, but could still make their way to and find God through a different faith. So, you know, what was the point of Jesus' life, ministry, and resurrection?
I think there's a difference between the revelation of God in Jesus Christ and the established Christian traditions and religion. Which would take another program.
The whole point of the established religious tradition is to reflect God's message as revealed through Jesus.
Yeah, I think you probably would find theologies which would say that there are common truths in non-Christian faiths and in and maybe in agnostic worldviews.
Sure,
too.
And in humanistic philosophies too. Yeah. I mean, my position ultimately is that we have, you know, natural explanations for the emergence of religious belief in humans, and which are not compatible with the idea that God is true. I mean, on the one hand, we have the idea that religion is a byproduct, a consequence of other cognitive mechanisms that evolved to solve other problems in human ancestral environments, and that would seem a strange way for God to create the religious impulse in man simply as a consequence of other aspects to how the human mind works. There's also the idea that religion is adaptation, which is not really covered. This is the idea that religion conferred survival advantages to our ancestors. One idea is that religion evolved to cement within sort of bands of hunter-gatherers, religion evolved as a means of social cohesion, a way to sort of unite the tribe into which one is born. You could say, well, this is the way that God did it. But then, you know, if it's the case that we naturally defer loyalty to the tribe into which we are born, such as the religion into which we are born, and this is God's way of doing it, then again, Christianity makes exclusive claims for itself. If you're born into an Islamic tradition, and you know, if Islam is true, Christianity must be false. I mean, in Islam, the greatest sin that one can commit is called shirk, equating partners with God. It's what every Christian does in the eyes of Islam. So these, you know, there's as much
room for compromise
as the toss of a coin. So you know, again, this creates problems. Is this the way that God would create the world?
So you have a kind of theological problem with it. If there is this evolutionary story at play, that seems a very unlikely way.
Look at the way the world is. We have a world divided into competing religious communities. Is this the way that God would have done things, or is it the way that man would have done things? Which is more likely, we have to ask ourselves, and I think the answer is quite clear.
I think in some sense, though, you have already been addressing that to some extent, in that you think there is a distinction between religion and what
I would say that I think that religion can be very easily understood as a human phenomenon, and I think it's a human phenomenon like other human phenomena that God inhabits, and I think he reveals himself through religions, and he reveals himself through the natural world, and he reveals himself through love relationships between people, and ultimately he reveals himself through Christ. I would say that because I'm a Christian, and I think I said it right at the beginning, the mapping of religions onto God and his desire to have a relationship with us is a complicated and complex and difficult area which we haven't completely addressed. And I think it's partly because the discourse in psychology of religion, cognitive science, evolutionary psychology, and all these kind of areas that are looking at religion, and the discourse in theology are very different discourses, and they just rarely speak with each other. So we need more interchange, really, and we need to be able to speak the same kind of languages and work out whether we're talking about the same phenomena or not. And I think the example there is that we focus a lot in this debate on, well, it's been a conversation, not a debate, on the reason that people think in certain ways and believe certain things. And that's, from a theological point of view, that's perhaps kind of it's a secondary issue. There are other things that might, you know, other ways of looking at the problem, other language we could be using.
Absolutely, and we often do look at them in various other ways on this programme. But thank you very much both for being with me. It's been a really interesting, challenging show, you know, to look at these areas, and I think we'll give people a lot of food for thought, as I said earlier.
Thanks again for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Hope that you enjoyed it. And you can find links to our newsletter, YouTube channel, the ways to give, and our archive of past shows at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.